Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, folks. How are you doing? Hey, as always, I'm doing pretty darn good. Hey, so, you know, there's just always something to do, right? Meaning chores, chores in the house, chores outside the house, chores in the car, chores outside the car, wash the car, clean the car, vacuum the house, mow the lawn, everything, whether it's raining or sunshiny. There's always something to do. And so, yeah, that's what I've been doing all day today is working in the yard because, man, what a beautiful day it was. So what have you been doing today? Anything productive? Well, I hope so. Hey, anyhow, today I have Dr. Ann Hester on. And what she's going to talk about is her book, The Patient Empowerment 101. There's actually more to the title, but that's the main part of the title. We're going to actually have a conversation about, you know, what is it that patients need to be aware of when they go see the doctor? What is it that the doctor needs, the type of information from the patient in order to help the patient better? We're going to cover things such as, you know, pain tolerance. What is that pain level when you're asked, well, how much is your pain or how does it feel from a scale of 1 to 10? I have no clue. I could tell you it's a 1, but it might be a 7 to you. So we cover that both for men and women. There's a lot of other things that we're going to talk about too. So sit back, enjoy. Please remember to share, like, and comment on this podcast. And hey, this goes out to the Lisas out there. You know who you are. It's nice meeting you. All right, so let's get with it. Let's go. With your book, The Patient Empowerment 101, and of course it's Patient Empowerment 101, or I want to clarify, patientempowerment101.com. Thank you very much for joining me today. And again, we've been kind of talking about, mentioned your book, Patient Empowerment 101.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at here the things that folks can actually learn from your book, which is really important. And I think I'm just going to read a couple of things right off the list you have here. It's how to optimize, you know, each medical encounter. And to me, what that kind of means is me as a patient walking in, I need to know what I need to ask. And I need to know how to answer the questions that the doctors ask me. Because I say that because I know with some elderly folks, my mom, you know, the doctors are asking a question. And I'm thinking, Mom, that's not the right answer because that's not what you said. And then, again, that just drops down to the specific questions doctors want to know about your symptoms and things like that. But there's a whole list of things. And you also help out, I think, on how to save money, because there's a lot of things in this insurance. You get these bills and you just don't know, or you might be, maybe you don't need a particular procedure. Maybe you do need a particular procedure. So sorry to take up all that time, but I mean, this is really, really important. And there's so much, so much. So I'll let you just jump right in and do your thing and tell us how we're going to ask and answer the right questions and how we're going to make the most out of our visit to the office, to the doctor's office.
First, let me frame where we are now.
Yeah.
The American Association of Medical Colleges, which is the organization that deals with medical school applications, so they know what they're talking about. So the AMC predicts a shortfall of up to 124,000 doctors in 11 years. That does not include the people who need care but are not getting care now, such as people in many rural communities and many urban communities. If you factor in the unmet needs in 11 years, America could be facing a shortage, a functional shortage, of over 180,000 doctors. If you think that the visitors are short now, stay tuned. It's alarming, and we're just not prepared for that. What my book, Patient Empowerment 101, more than a book, it's an adventure, delves into is multiple things that patients can do. For instance, I once timed a patient. I asked her a yes or no question. It took her 10 minutes to answer. I just let her keep talking because I wanted to time to see how long it would take. Patients have not been taught how to really partner in their healthcare. So one chapter goes to the basics of how you communicate with your doctor. Up until January of this year, Medicare and many other insurance carriers mandated that a doctor document some combination of eight key elements. We called it the HPI, or the history of present illness. And so in addition to needing this for insurance reimbursement purposes, these eight elements are profound because they help a doctor pinpoint what likely is and likely is not going on. So it went far past many. For instance, if you have a piece of paper and a pencil, please write these down. They're very important. So there are eight elements. And I recommend that you try to think of some sort of mnemonic so you remember it. Let's say you live in Ohio and you love the Cleveland Cavs and you go to the stadium. So in this case, I created a mnemonic CCL stadium. The I and U have nothing to do. They're just part of the mnemonic, but whatever is meaningful to you, that would work. So C, context. What was happening around the time you noticed the problem? For instance, it's one thing to say, doctor, I have back pain. It's another thing to say, doctor, I have pain in the low back that started right after I picked up some heavy furniture. The doctor is not going to order a lot of expensive tests and procedures if you tell him that. The next C is the character. Think of some adjectives. Describe the problem. If you say, doctor, I have chest pain, that doesn't mean a lot. Doctor, I have crushing chest pain, or I have burning chest pain, or I have tight, squeezing, sharp chest pain. The character means a lot. L is location. Be specific. If you say, I have belly pain, that doesn't mean a whole lot. You have a lot of organs in there. You have an appendix, you have a gallbladder, a liver, a spleen, so on and so forth. Be as specific as you can. Doctor, my pain hurts in the upper right abdomen below my rib cage, or it hurts around my belly button, or it hurts in the lower right abdomen. If you can be specific, you can help the doctor rule in or rule out specific diagnoses. If you have acute appendicitis and you say, my pain hurts in the upper abdomen and it's a burning pain, it's probably not going to look for appendicitis. But if you say, I have pain in the right lower abdomen, then that may help them hone in on that, as opposed to something like gastritis, stomach line inflammation, for instance, for the upper abdominal burning pain. Then you have severity. We like to use a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being mild and 10 being, oh my gosh. So think this through. I once had a patient who told me his pain was a 10 over 10. So I walked into his hospital room. What's your pain today, Mr. Jones? Oh, it's a 10 over 10. He was texting, watching TV, no element of distress whatsoever. So that let me know he did not know what 10 over 10 meant. 10 over 10 for women is like, you're in the middle of childbirth. And then T for timing. Each time it happens, how long does it last? Seconds, minutes, or hours? The A is associated signs and symptoms. For instance, when I have pain in my upper abdomen, I have nausea and vomiting. Duration. How long have you endured the problem? It's been going on for 6 months. Each time it comes, it lasts 2 or 3 minutes. So the duration is 6 months. The timing is 2 to 3 minutes. Again, I and you have nothing to do. They're just part of the mnemonic. M is modifying factors. If you say, whenever I have a headache, I lie in a dark room and it's quiet and the headache goes away quickly. That says something. If you've taken multiple acetaminophen pills plus Advil as often as you can, and those things are not budging the pain, that says something too. So what makes it better? What makes it worse? So again, C, context. C, character. L, location. S, severity. T, timing. A, associated signs and symptoms. D, duration. And M, modifying factors. So if you think these things through, whenever you develop a symptom, you can walk to the doctor's office and give a 1 minute elevator speech. And the doctor is probably going to ask you if you're in the medical field. But the point is, you can give a 1 minute elevator speech and immediately he can start thinking, this could be this. It's definitely not this. So by the time you finish your last sentence, the doctor will have a short list of what could potentially be going on. And that means fewer tests, fewer procedures, less of a need for medication trials to see if it works when it really doesn't, and it just causes side effects and costs you money. So that's one of the major things that people can do.
Okay. Two things out of that. One is the S for severity, because like you gave that example, I often hear from people and I see when they are asked, what is that level 1 to 10? And I am one included. My first thought is, well, my 3 is probably your 9. So I don't really know how to answer that exactly. For you giving an example, especially for women, to say, well, think of it this way. Have you ever had a pregnancy? Yes. Have you given birth? Yes. That is consider that a 10.
Oh, yes.
For men, I don't know what you would use for an example. Maybe you have
a broken bone. Now, if you follow, you've broken a bone. If it's something that is bringing you to your knees, bringing you to tears, whatever the case may be, that's a 10. So one is it doesn't impact you. 5 is moderate. I can still go to work. 10 is either 911 or give me some IV pain medicine if you're in the hospital. It's excruciating.
That's very, very helpful. Because like I said, it's one of those situations where I, again, for myself, I never knew how to judge, and no doctor that I have ever been to has ever given an example of this is what you would consider it to be a 10. So that's very helpful for both men and women that you give an example for. And, you know, the other thing too is whose fault is it when you go through these trials? Like you mentioned, you know, sometimes it's really the patient's fault. And when I say this, it's when you say, well, they didn't give you enough information. And that's the thing I go through with an elderly parent or person, is you need to be tell them exactly what you're telling me. Don't try to guess what you're trying to say, because this is why you're going through different types of medication. And that is why it costs more money. Get to the point. So with that being said, you stress the fact that, you know, you could give a 1 minute elevator speech. How do we convince the patients, people, really, to understand this?
A lot of people are frustrated with the healthcare system, and they don't like spending 45 minutes in a waiting room and having a 5-minute visit only to be told, I'm going to order these tests and procedures, come back to see me in 2 weeks, this is a prescription. So I think people are getting to the point that they're saying, enough is enough. I want to have a seat at the table. This is my health. And when a person is motivated, a person will do better. If the person is just, well, the doctor would tell me what to do, I'm not going to really worry about it, it's going to be hard to convince them until something happens. That being said, I actually wrote the first version of this book over 20 years ago. It was called Your Family Medical Record, An Interactive Guide to Getting the Best Care. And it was published by John Wiley & Sons about 2000. But at that time, people didn't want to partner with their care. They say, well, the doctor tells me what to do, and I just do it. Fast forward all these years, people are now realizing that what happens to them has a lot to do with their choices, their decisions. They want to be informed. So there are going to be people who say, I want to know everything. I want to know how I can put myself at the center of my healthcare team. And there are going to be people who say, I don't get sick that often. I'm not going to worry about that. And that's their choice. And some people, unfortunately, will find themselves in a situation, whether they're lying in an emergency room or whatever the case may be, that they would wish I knew how to communicate with doctors. So this is not just for 60-year-olds who have 2 medical problems. This is for everybody. If you are an adult, if you're 18 and you're going to be giving your own history, it's important. If you're 90, it's important. If you're a mom, it's important, because you also will know how to put things together and what to start looking for so you can do it on behalf of your children. So these are kind of inside tips that doctors know. I mean, we know what we need. We know what we're looking for, and we know the significance. Nurses know. but we have not done a really good job educating people on how to empower themselves, because the bottom line is it's about them. It's not about physicians. Mm-hmm. It's about how can we work together to optimize the health and the health care of all the patients and give them the care that they deserve. And part of that does require a patient to take an active role and really care about what happens and put forth the effort to do better and to communicate in such a way that the doctor can hone down the potential diagnosis. Think of it as a dartboard. So the doctor has all these darts and he's throwing, and they're all over the place. If you give him the information he needs, he's more likely to get the bullseye quickly instead of having to go all over the place. And in the meantime, your suffering is prolonged. You're getting medications that cost you money that can have side effects that interact with things. You might be getting tests and procedures that are not only uncomfortable, but potentially dangerous and very expensive. Why? Why go there? This is very basic. It's very simple. People just have to have the desire to want to know.
Well put on that one, especially about saving the monies. Now, what I'm wondering is, stepping aside from empowering the patient, have doctors experienced problems with patients who come in thinking that they know too much, meaning they use the internet and come in and they've self-diagnosed, and then they say, here's what's going on. Mm-hmm. Can you fix that? So stepping on the doctor's side, what happens there?
Doctors are individuals. Some will say, you know, let me go through the steps and then we'll see if you're right, or let me just put that aside and you tell me what's going on and then we'll work it out and then we can address your concerns afterwards. Every doctor has his or her own way of dealing with these things. What you don't want to do is go to the doctor's office with 3 inches of papers that you got from the internet, because the red flag is going to go up. And so if you can communicate with the doctor and help him help you, then that will kind of calm a lot of these things. And that does not mean that your one-minute elevator speech is going to get you the correct diagnosis 100% of the time. It means that it will save time, it will save money, and it's absolutely in your best interest just to know the sorts of things doctors want to know about.
Yeah, it's... I guess what I'm really getting out of this is we need, your book is talking about empowering ourselves, but it also, to me, it means we need to take responsibility and be forthright in the information that we're going to provide to the doctors. Yeah. Otherwise, the doctors cannot do their jobs. So I guess it goes back to kind of quoting off of one of the movies that we all know about, Help Me, Help You, is basically what it comes down to, right?
It is. Now, you would not give a mechanic $1,000 to fix your car if you didn't know what he was charging you for. This is your life. So if you put it into perspective, then you have to look at things differently.
When should a person go to the doctor? So they've self-diagnosed themselves. So let's say that it could be appendicitis or something. Do they try to fix themselves at home and potentially make it worse? Or do they look at this and be truthful about what is happening and say, you know, I'm going to the doctors with the information that I have, my 8 bits of information, I know where it's hurting, I know the time period, I know all of this, I better go. Do they wait a while or do they go right away?
Listen to your body. If it's severe, it's 911.
Okay.
A lot of doctors, there are triage areas. So you call the doctor and you may speak with his nurse or his receptionist and you can relay your symptoms. And then the doctor would get back with you. That's concerning. Bring him in or go to the hospital, or you need to be seen at a minor emergency center. I'm booked for the day if it's non-urgent. And so the first thing would be to call your doctor. That being said, if you have symptoms of a stroke, it's 911. If you have weakness on one side, your smile is off, you're dropping things, you're confused, that's 911.
Okay.
Severe chest pressure, that's 911. But something like, you know, my belly is hurting, is moderate, not too bad. You have time, in most cases, to contact the doctor. It's not common that you can have a level one or two abdominal pain and then end up with a life-threatening situation in 30 minutes. That's not common. I don't like to say anything is impossible, but listen to your body. If that warning sign is going off, you know, something's not right here, and you need to call the paramedics, then do it. We'd much rather you wait, you not wait, than wait and have things happen. I remember I had one patient at the VA hospital. You know, he said, you know, Doc, I'm having this, you know, this indigestion is just not feeling right. He was a diabetic. For a diabetic, indigestion could mean a heart attack. I looked at his EKG, I'm like, no, this is a heart attack. People, you have to err on the side of caution. If it's something that's just not right, and you know you have this strange sensation, do something. Don't wait. I've had people say, you know, I've been having this problem for a while. I just thought I'd wait it out. That weakness of that leg that started 4 days ago, it was a stroke, and now it's too late to give you the clot busters. So there are certain things that necessitate immediate action and there are things that do not. So when in doubt, you can always call if you're very concerned, 911. If you're not extremely concerned, call your doctor and make sure the message gets through quickly. And if you don't hear back in the doctor's swamp, you don't hear back, you're getting worse, seek medical attention. Just go ahead and go to the hospital. And if it's something like weakness, blurred vision, anything neurologic, severe headache, bad chest pain, don't drive yourself. If you're in the midst of a heart attack or stroke, the last thing you want to do is pass out on the highway.
Right.
And then if something happens, they're going to be focused on your broken bones, not the fact that you had a stroke, which caused it, or a heart attack, which caused it. So always err on the side of caution. Also, don't have your family member drive you to the hospital if you're having stroke symptoms. You need to call the paramedics.
Okay.
Same with a heart attack, because they could run some diagnostic tests, do an evaluation, and actually potentially start treatment in the ambulance before you get to the hospital. So don't have your family member drive you in an emergency. Call 911.
Thank you for that advice. I mean, that's really good, because not that I know personally, but I have heard where people say, you know, they're having their family members drive, but we never think that being in the ambulance that they could begin diagnosing, seeing what's going on, possibly like to give you some sort of treatment, whether it be fluids or anything like that. Yeah.
And also, as far as the ambulance, if there's stroke-like symptoms, there are certain designated stroke hospitals. So if you're clearly having a stroke, that ambulance may not take you to the hospital down the street. They may take you to the dedicated stroke center a few blocks over. So that's just another reason.
Okay. Now, stepping away a little bit from all this severe case scenarios and things like that, you know, sometimes, and this is what I've experienced too, you go to the doctors and you're having your annual tests.
Mm-hmm.
Should patients ask for more? Because oftentimes it just seems like, you know, I've heard it from friends too, where they say, you know, they drew blood and they tested for this and this and this, but they didn't test for that. Why didn't they? Meaning if you have, I don't know the terminology, but if you have your, I'm just going to call it plates or blood samples, you have your blood drawn and it's checking for certain things. Maybe there's five things that the doctors always check for. Should you ask for something extra? Should you say, you know, I want a full workup and then some. I want to have tests for my testosterone levels, because that's not a normal thing, right? They don't check that annually. It's something that you should ask for. Is it okay for people to ask for more? Suggest?
There are national guidelines as far as what is really needed. So we are looking at an extremely expensive healthcare system where the outcomes in America are not what you would expect. expect, we're not at the top as far as the outcomes. If you look at some of the other advanced countries, people would be surprised where we are. Spending money does not mean better care. Okay. So there are established guidelines. You need to have this test checked in, this test checked in. You need to get your blood pressure checked. You need to have these things. And they're based on scientific research. And so to go in and say, well, I don't have a testosterone, I don't have this and that, if everybody did that, it would bankrupt the system, and it's not likely to do any good. So there's really no point. I don't do it. You know, the last time I went to seek medical advice, like, you know, I'm having this symptom, I want to have this test done. And by the way, my last test for this was a little bit abnormal. Will you check this too? Pinpoint specific things. There are so many tests. Literally, we could go bankrupt if everybody got every test on every visit. And there's no reason for that. And also, there are a lot of the potential for false positives. So you can get a test that, oh, it's a little bit abnormal. Doesn't mean anything. Well, let's just go ahead and get a biopsy. Let's go ahead and get this or that. And it's like chasing your tail. You put a person at risk of things happening. There was no change in the outcome. There were no symptoms. There was no reason to do these things. And so if you do a complete panel of tests every time you go, you're looking into the many, many thousands of dollars. And there's no reason for that, because there are national guidelines based on what has been proven to make a difference. Okay. And certainly if you have symptoms, if you have signs of low testosterone, certainly. If you have signs of another problem, absolutely. But that's the point of telling your doctor your symptoms. So then your doctor can say, it may be A, B, C, D, or E. Let me check the test that look for A, B, C, D, and E, not G, R, H, Q, and so forth.
Bottom line on two things is doctor knows best, but you need to provide the right answers to the question, which helps you save money. You, when I say you, it's the patient, right? And that's all part of your, yeah, this is all part of your Patient Empowerment 101 book. Again, these are, these things that we're talking about seem so matter of fact, and like, well, of course, but so many of us just don't do
no
that.
Idea. And that is not the fault of the patients. We have had a very paternalistic healthcare system. And now people are realizing we can't keep going this way. And people are demanding to know more, and they should know more, but they need the right tools. Doctors and patients should not be going back and forth. We should be one. So when patients are given the tools to interact on a level that the doctor can pick up the information and move forward in a methodical, cost-effective manner, that's a win-win. Something else I talk about in the book is the hospital. A lot of people don't realize all the things that can go wrong in a hospital. If you are lying in bed and you're not being prophylaxed, given medicine to decrease your risk of a blood clot, you could have a life-threatening or even fatal blood clot. That could be your first symptom. I go through a variety of things in the chapter on hospitalizations. Those things are important not just for us, but most of us. My parents are deceased, but a lot of people, they have parents who are still alive, and they may have a spouse who's going to end up in the hospital. Even if they're extremely healthy, there's going to be someone in that person's life who's going to end up in the hospital. Everything from preventing blood clots to urinary infections to bloodstream infections, all of those things that we know about and national centers know about, and they say, well, this is what we're going to do to decrease death from this, 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 and this. Patients don't know. They've got to know. They've got to know when they refuse that tiny injection in the belly underneath the skin to decrease the risk of blood clots, that they may be decreasing their chances of something major. And a lot of people are tired, like, just go away. I don't want it. They have no idea what they're doing to themselves. In addition, a lot of people have insurance companies that have these portals, and you can get in and you can check your records. But what happens when you change insurance companies? You change jobs, you change doctors. People need a copy of the records. That's not to say that they need detailed copies of hundreds of pages of everything. No. If you're hospitalized, get a copy of your discharge summary. A few pages long, typed. We have everything that you need to know. When you go to the doctor's office, know the diagnosis and don't accept you have a kidney problem. What does that mean? It could be many things. Write down the name, the specific name of each diagnosis that you have. If you have an adverse reaction to a drug, don't assume it's an allergy. For instance, a lot of people, they get stomach upset with aspirin. That's not an allergy. A true aspirin allergy can kill you. If you're having a heart attack, it can help save your life. So you want the doctor to understand what happens. It's not, I'm allergic to aspirin. Or your family member may say, my husband's allergic to aspirin. And the doctor may think, oh my gosh, I cannot risk this. Something bad happening. Let me not give aspirin when aspirin is due. The same with penicillin. Women get yeast infections. That's not an allergy. You might need a penicillin derivative. But if you say, I'm penicillin allergic, you might not get it. On my site, patientempowerment101.com, if you scroll down to the bottom, I have a free downloadable form. You print it, turn it over, turn the paper over, print again. So on one page, front and back, you can have your mini medical record. You fill it out. You keep it in your wallet. You might go out to have dinner with some friends tonight and end up in an emergency room. Just pull it out. You might be too sick to really talk. You might have been given pain medicine. If you pull this out, the doctor will see your medical problems, your drug allergies, your medications, all of these things in one place. So people really need to understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah. And this made me think immediately of, you know, when we get older and we're talking to a healthcare professional or somebody may mention, hey, do you have, and I don't know what the name of the form is, but the DNR and all that taped to your refrigerator, maybe something like this. People should have the list of medications, the exact terms or exact words of what it is that's happening. So it's right there. So and tell your children or tell your friends if you're single, if, in case something happens, this yellow piece of paper on my refrigerator door is a list of my medications and whatever else. That would be
absolutely really good. And family members do need that, need access. And also what I suggest is take your bottles and the list if you go to the hospital, the doctor's office. The reason is, let's say you go to the hospital. One of the most common reasons a person ends up at the hospital with congestive heart failure, which is like the most common reason people over 65 end up hospitalized, is they might have missed medication or they may have taken in too much salt. You go to the emergency room with a bag of your medications and the doctor can pull it out and say, okay, Lasix, you got 30 pills on this day, but you have 28 pills left. You only have 20 pills left. Those are the sorts of things that will really help healthcare professionals figure out what's going on. If you just take your list and you say, yeah, I think I take it all the time, you might have missed several doses, which could be why you're in the hospital in the first place. And so instead of ordering all of these tests and procedures to try to figure out why you got worse, the doctor can easily say, she didn't take her medicine. She missed a lot of doses. Let me do this, tweak it, and we're done. And that could save you a tremendous amount of time and money. You don't want to be in the hospital unless you absolutely have to be.
You know, every time, this is going to sound wrong, but every time you open your mouth, you bring up a new thing that's so important.
I'm glad to help. This is my passion.
It really, there's more to it than what me as a patient would think, but then it's less because it's so obvious, but we just don't do it. We're talking about medications. We're talking about making sure that you not only have the list, but if you bring your medication in with you, they can count and say, you've only taken two this month and you should have already taken 18.
Very common.
And I will have to guess that there's a lot of people who don't do any of this, but they go in and the doctors say, here's a list of medications. Are you still taking these? And they just go, yeah, which... probably 9 times out of 10, they are not.
Absolutely. And then you have to keep in mind there's the generic name and there's the brand name. And so if you bring in your little bag with all the medications in the bag, and this has happened so often, So a person will get medications, generic, and or even brand and generic, and the pills look different. And they may be focused on the generic name one time, the brand name, and this other thing. So they're taking both of these pills. They end up in kidney failure or something else is going on because they're overdosing because they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I suggest, and I go over this in the book, you need to know the brand and the generic name. You also need to know the doctor who prescribed it, the pharmacy. So if you're in the ER, the ER doctor or the nurse can call the pharmacist, when was the last time the medication was filled? Yeah. That's important, you know, because some people may put new pills in an old bottle. It never really makes sense to me, but a lot of people, they're so used to this old raggedy bottle, they just keep dumping the new pills in it because they're used to it. So, pardon me, all of these things are vital. And you're right, people who know, we know because that's what we've been dealing with. People who were not given the information, and we cannot expect them to know. And so Patient Empowerment 101, it actually only took a few months to write the book because it's what I've done day after day for decades. And so it was very simple for me to put all this down, but people have not been given the information. And my hope and desire is that by reading this book, they'll learn everything from how to save money on the insurance, to the significance of advanced directives, how to communicate with doctors, how to stay safe in the hospital. A lot of people don't realize the significance of patient advocates. There are actually people who have businesses. They are professional advocates. They can advocate for your health. They can explain your insurance forms. They can talk to the doctor on your behalf. They can go to the hospital with you if you don't have family. So there are so much that people just don't know that can have a tremendous impact on their lives and even the life expectancy.
Well, I'll say a good place to start is by going to, you know, patientempowerment101.com. That's a great place to start because I am looking at your website right now, and you know, you've really got it broken down into a lot of good things, videos to watch. This is great.
Right.
So, everything that we talked about right here, expedite your own diagnosis, find the right doctor. I mean, you've got everything right here. So this is a well put together website with a lot of information, which means, again, I don't want to wear it out, but, you know, patientempowerment101.com and go there, get the book. I'm sure it's available on Amazon and every place else, right?
It is. And I guess you're in the internal pages that deal with the videos, and actually there are a lot of forms you can download, fill out, print, email yourself if you have abdominal pain, chest pain, so forth, the specific FAQs the doctors want to know. All of those are internal pages that you can only get to if you have the information that's in the book. So the main public-facing website is just the patientempowerment101.com. But then internally, there are videos and other things that people can use and continue to download forms and improve things. In addition, there is the companion book that on patientempowerment101.com, if you click on the link for the companion book, you can actually get like a little workbook that goes along with the main book. That way, both of them will take you to the Amazon pages, though.
This has been really enlightening and very informational. So I want to say thank you because now I have not done a lot of these things that we were talking about. Although they're the obvious things, I'm probably 90% of the general population.
99%.
I just have not gone out there and done it. So again, Dr. Hester, this has been wonderful. Is there anything in closing that you want to let people know?
Yes. I have seen so many people suffer and die unnecessarily. That does not have to be. We are intelligent people. We can take charge of what happens to us. We don't have to just sit back and allow all these things to happen that we could have had impact in. Everything from not knowing your medical history to taking the wrong medication. There's so many things. People die of fatal PEs, a pulmonary embolus, commonly in the hospital, just because they don't know. They may refuse the medication to prevent it, or they just don't know what they're doing to themselves. There's so much information out there. Everybody deserves the best possible chance he or she can have in the healthcare system. For you, for your loved ones, for people, the generation above, your current generation, and the generation below. We have to become an empowered people. We cannot handle this tsunami of a healthcare crisis that we're looking at. If everybody took control, made it a point to learn more and be more involved in their care, then when this tsunami hits in 11 years and the waves are already crashing on the shores, we're already seeing doctor shortages all over the place. But when it hits its peak, we'll be in a much better position to weather this unprecedented storm. And I thank you so much for having me and allowing me to share with your audience some things that I hope will help save their lives and help improve their care.
Well, thank you for helping provide the information out there for all of us.
More than my pleasure.